In verse 9, he says, "But beloved, we're convinced of better things concerning you." In other words, listen, we know that you're not going to go out and deny Christ. And well, I just believe so much better about you. I believe that you're going to be mighty for God. You're going to read this letter. You're going to rally. And you're going to realize, hey, you know what? I'm going to stand like a soldier and I'm going to fight for Christ. And he goes, "I'm convinced of better things about you." And he goes, including, watch what he says. He says, "Concerning you and the things that accompany salvation, though we are speaking in this way." In other words, even though I'm speaking to you in a harsh tone, and even though I'm really hitting this kind of hard and giving you some stern warnings, I want you to know, hey, listen, I know you're going to come out great. And you know what? I know that as you progress toward maturity, you're going to have an incredible understanding of all of these things. These things which accompany salvation. And you know what? You walk up to a man that knows the positional truth doctrines and tell him he can lose his salvation. He'll look at you and go, "Me? The guy who's seated with Christ in heavenly places, me? The guy who no weapon formed against me shall prosper, moi? The one that nothing can ever separate me from God's love? Are we talking about the same person? No, I can't lose my salvation," because he knows the positional truth verses. "Hey, do you realize I'm elect? Do you realize I'm foreknown? Do you realize I'm called? Do you realize I'm..." See what I mean? "Do you realize I'm glorified?" "You're not glorified." "Oh, yes, I am. In the mind of God, I'm just as glorified as I am called. I'm already glorified as a retropositional fact right now. It's a historical present, as the Jehovah Witnesses made up a tense to disprove a Bible verse. Oh, that's a historical present. You think about it for a minute. A historical present. Something happening in the present, which is historical. Hysterical present is more like it. "I beheld Satan as he fell from heaven." Oh, that's a historical present, they say. Jesus said, "I beheld Satan as he fell from heaven." No, you know what it meant? It meant, "I beheld in the past Satan as he fell from heaven." That's what he said. It wasn't a historical present. There's no such thing. It's ridiculous. So then it says, it sounds good though, doesn't it? When the Jehovah Witness walks into the house of somebody that doesn't know anything about the original language, see how deceitful it is? And well, how about, oh yeah, but this is a special tense in the Greek. It's called, oh, special isn't even the word for it. This is unique. Oh yeah, very unique. You don't hear about a lot of historical presence in any language. "But we, beloved, are concerned or convinced of better things concerning you." That's the 33 things that accompany salvation. And we know you'd never do that. And we're concerned of better things concerning you, even though we're speaking to you in this way. In other words, in a harsh tone. For God, listen, he goes, "Come on, I know you're suffering." And that's why I like the interpretation of the, you know, those of you who are in this class, "Do you really? Do you know that we're suffering, Pastor Gene? Let us go. Let us leave." But he says, listen, that's why I like the interpretation that I do about the interpretation that I believe about Hebrews chapter 4, Hebrews chapter 6, verses 4 through 6, because it follows the context better. He's saying, listen, come on, don't shrink back. Don't deny Christ and think that you can just confess it. And then he says, here, listen, he goes, "But listen, God is not so unjust to forget your work. God knows that when you don't deny him and you go through the hard times, God's not going to forget your work. God's not going to forget the way that you minister to the saints. He's coming quickly and his reward is with him." You see what I mean? So it all fits into a beautiful context. "For God is not so unjust to forget your work and the love which you have shown toward his name, and having ministered and are still and is still ministering to the saints." He goes, God's not going to forget that. Just persevere. He's coming quickly. And listen, let me show you this. Keep your hand here and go to Hebrews chapter 10. Here's another favorite verse of mine. Hebrews chapter 10. In verse 35, oh, you're going to love this. This is going to bless you. Watch this. Hebrews 10, verse 35. "Therefore, do not throw away," or discard as useless, literally. "Do not discard as useless your confidence, which has with it a great reward." Do you see that? "For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what has been promised." Do you see the tone of the letter? Hey, listen, don't throw away your confidence. It carries with it a great reward. And listen, all we have to do is take some patience. We have need of patience so that after we've accomplished the will of God. What is the will of God? It's the divine desideratum for your life. I can say it to Eddie right now. I can say, Eddie, God, when the moment he saved you, he had the very first point in this thing. It says, you are in the eternal plan of God, foreknown, elect, predestined, chosen, called, to what? To a specific plan that God blueprinted for your life specifically. You have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, what is that? The specific plan that God blueprinted for you, you will receive what has been promised you. Hey, there's a reward coming. Does any of this have to do with salvation? It's talking about the production of the believer's life. And unfortunately, because people don't take an academic and contextual approach to the scriptures, they take chapter 6 out of context. Ask them what chapter 5 is about. When someone comes up to you and they're going to try to prove you wrong by quoting from Hebrews chapter 6, ask them, what is Hebrews chapter 5 about? And they say, I don't know. Well, don't you think you ought to know the context? Don't you think you ought to know what Paul, Listen, I do it all the time. Paul wrote 3/4 of the New Testament. I can't help it. You know, if you don't know and you just say Paul, it's three times out of four, you're going to be right. If they come to you and they say, well, look at this in Hebrews chapter 6, what's Hebrews chapter 5 about? Don't you think you ought to know what precipitated the writer of Hebrews to write Hebrews chapter 6? What was he even talking about? Listen to this. Whenever you have a chapter that begins in Hebrews chapter 6 verse 1 with the word therefore, a light ought to go on in your mind. Hey, therefore, what, therefore? Why, that sounds like a conclusion. 1 plus 1 is 2. Therefore, I mean, you don't start a sentence with there, I went to school today and it was raining. Therefore, my head got wet. Therefore is a conclusion. Apollos is concluding something. What is he concluding? He's saying, listen, I'm telling you that all of these things about pressing on to maturity are absolutely necessary if you're going to get what's been promised. Go to 2 John. Go to 2 John. The great letter to the great lady. 2 John. I love it. You know what? Hey, listen to this. You want to hear a good one? Want to hear a good one? You Calvinites out there will like this one. Listen to how 2 John begins. This is what the Apostle John, in the elderly, in the final twilight of his years, this is how he spoke of the church. He said, to the elder, that's John, to the chosen lady and her children whom I love in the truth. You know who the chosen lady is? The church, in that location he was writing to. And then look at this though. Let's begin with verse 7. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. He was dealing with something very important here called incipient Gnosticism. Incipient Gnosticism is like the opposite of the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witnesses believed that Jesus was really a man, but he wasn't really God. The Gnostics believed that, and it was the greatest threat to Christianity in the first couple of centuries. It was incredible. Matter of fact, the book of Colossians was written for the express purpose of blowing down Gnosticism, and so was 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. But he said, and by the way, I mean, John was so unbelievably, in non-canonical writings, the early church fathers preserved for us, that John was once asked, John once went into a bathhouse where, I can't remember his name, Cerinthus. Cerinthus was a guy that was one of these guys who was a Gnostic, and he was saying that Jesus wasn't really a human, he was only divine. He appeared to be human. And John goes into a bathhouse, and Cerinthus is there taking a bath, and John runs out of the bathhouse. And someone said, John, why did you run out? He won't hurt you. He goes, no, I'm afraid that at any moment that God's going to strike that man dead, and I don't want to be in the same room with him when he does. That's what he said. According to the early church fathers. But this Gnosticism was going out. And by the way, go back to 1 John. Let me give you a little quick lesson about 1 John. Look at it quickly. 1 John chapter 1. Look at how he writes this. It's very, very important the way John begins this letter. You shouldn't have to go too far now. About maybe 2 or 3 pages back. What was from the beginning, what we have heard. He's talking about Christ. What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have beheld with our hands, what we handled concerning the word of life. And the life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness, and we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and what we have heard, we proclaim to you, that you also might have... Do you see the emphasis there? It's, listen, we heard him. We touched him. We ate with him. Don't tell me he wasn't a person. We saw him bleed. Don't tell me he wasn't a person. You see, the whole book is written to knock down Gnosticism, which made idols of men. Look at the very last verse in the whole book. It sums up the purpose of the whole book. Little children, guard yourself from idols. That's what the whole book's about. Now, back to 2 John. Many deceivers, in verse 7, have gone out into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. In other words, they'll acknowledge his divinity, but they won't acknowledge his deity. And it says, this is the deceiver and the antichrist. Now, John's always throwing this term antichrist around. He uses it a lot. But it doesn't deal with the eschatological antichrist, but it deals with the spirit of antichrist, or anyone that is anti-Christ. Okay? It doesn't mean the antichrist. Okay? But then he says, watch this, because this is important for us. He says, watch yourselves that you might not lose what we have accomplished. Well, who's we? Who do you think is we? Those who have taught you. Listen, you're sitting in this room tonight. If you learned something about God that you didn't know before you came in, then I have accomplished something in your life through a spiritual gift that God gave me. The water fell onto the field of his life. And because there was fruit there, you ate from it and you were blessed. You see? So the idea is, John says, listen, spent a lot of time with you guys. I've accomplished things. I've brought you to a level of maturity where you're ready to get rewards. This is what he's saying. I've brought you to a level of maturity where you're ready to stand before God and get rewards. Don't you dare. Watch yourselves. Watch yourselves that you do not lose what we have accomplished in you, but that you may receive a full reward. That verse right there is the subject of the book of Hebrews. Getting a full reward. Don't shrink back. He's coming. And listen, you know what? Now, you're thinking of shrinking back. Here's what I'm going to do. Watch the logic that Apollos employs. You're thinking of shrinking back. You're thinking of stepping back a little bit, hiding. He goes, listen, let me tell you something. You're thinking of saying, hey, I'm not a Christian. I don't want to. I'm not going to say I'm a Christian. I'm going to say I'm a Jew, and I'm just going to kind of get over here alone with you know the other Jews, and then when it passes, then I'll just say that I'll get saved again, and because I'm kind of ashamed to name the name of Christ because I know the danger it can bring to me. You know what Apollos does? He says, "Listen, let me tell you about this high priest. Let me tell you who he is. Remember Melchizedek? Well, I'm summarizing chapter 7. Remember Melchizedek?" Remember Abraham met him on the plains after the slaughter of the kings? By the way, God blessed that slaughter of the kings. There are some kings that deserve to be slaughtered. Most of them have towels wrapped around their heads. Now watch this. He says, he went back from the slaughter of the kings, and you know what? He says, listen, this man met another man by the name of Melchizedek, and this man Melchizedek blessed our father Abraham. Abraham. Now you remember Abraham. Abraham. You remember Abraham. Abraham's the one that got all the promises from God. Do you want to know something else? Listen to this. This is going to blow your mind. Do you know that when Abraham stood before Melchizedek, inside his loins, the back of, lack of a better, that's what the Bible says, but I don't know a better word for it, but in his genetic makeup, in his biology, was the entire Levitical priesthood. Isn't that true? Is it true? Because Levi would come from Abraham. True? He says that when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, the entire Levitical priesthood paid tithes to Melchizedek. And then Melchizedek, who has no father and no mother, neither beginning of days nor end of years, blessed Abraham. Now he says, who do you think is greater? So he says, listen, you have a high priest that you don't have to be ashamed of. You don't have to be ashamed of your high priest. He's great and he's glorious and he's wonderful. And that's what he does, is he spends the next four chapters showing how wonderful Christ is as a high priest and the amazing sacrifice that he did on our behalf. We don't have to be ashamed. You know what? We ought to take heart tonight. We ought to say, you know what? I'm ashamed of Christ in my life in some area. Maybe there's some times where I'm not willing to speak out with boldness about Christ. Maybe there's some times when, you know, I've been around certain people, I kind of, you know, We don't have to be ashamed. This is something I think as you grow, you certainly, you know, if you've been around God for a while, and Tommy Cabral, you're not ashamed to name the name of Christ. That's all there is to it. But the idea is, you know what? Because he's a great soul winner. And the thing is, every single person you meet, Paul, do you remember when we were in Thessaloniki? We were in Thessaloniki, and the church in Greece was having a little bit of a problem. They weren't soul winning. You know what had happened? They'd lost heart. Remember? Isn't it true, Paul? They had lost heart. I mean, they had seen their church split from 70 people down to 10 because of evil reports. And we're over there, and we're building them up, and we're new. I mean, they don't know us. And we remember how scared we were on that train from Athens to Thessaloniki? We're like, oh, you know, I says, I'm filled with apprehension right now. Because I don't know if we're going to be received well because of the fact that it's just some problems that had happened before. But the thing is, you know what we did? You know what Paul and I purposed to do? Here's what we said. We said, we're going there, we're going to be so stinking positive and so energetic that they're going to get caught up in our fire. And then you know what else? Remember that night in Athens when you were trying to sleep and I wouldn't let you? And I kept saying, here's what we'll do, Paul. I said, because we didn't even have a vision for them. We didn't even have a vision for what to do there. And then all of a sudden I said, Paul, I've got it. I know exactly what we can do. We'll go over there and we'll tell them, here's what we're going to do. We're going to come over here a year from now with 50 to 70 people. And Paul said, yeah, we can do. And then I started to talk about it a little bit. And the more we talked about it, the more we both started to believe it. Isn't it true? And then we got there and we get there the first night. We're in the car. They just got us from the train station. And Paul's in the back seat with Sakis and Yorgos. And I'm in the front seat with Demetrius. And I'm turned around, kneeling down, facing the back, and screaming at these guys about how we're going to bring 50 to 70 people here. And we're going to win Thessaloniki for Christ. A couple days later, I says to Paul, I says, here's what we want to do. We want to go, and we're going to ask them to bring us to the highest place in Thessaloniki so that we can see the whole city and we can pray over it and claim it for Christ. Remember? And we told Yorgos, and I says to Yorgos, we want to go to the highest place in the city. Got the whole church up there to the highest place where you could see the whole city. And I said, you know what we're going to do tonight? This city belongs to Christ if you believe it. If you have the faith, this city belongs to Christ, and there's nothing that any demon in hell can ever do to stop it from happening. By the time we left, you know what? They started believing in their church again. You know what else? Listen to this. Paul and I are talking again, and what we decided to do was that because they weren't soul winning, we were going to hand out a tract to everything that breathed. And if it didn't breathe, we'd put it down and put a rock on top of it. And you know what? We're driving down the street, and I think it was Paul had just handed a tract to the guy in the car on the side of us that had stopped. Was stopped in traffic, and he goes, here, you want to read this? And, you know, take this thing. And you know what Pastor Yogo said? You remember this time in the car? Remember we were up by the old castle, and we're driving up the day we went to the zoo, and we're up by the old castle, and you know what Yogo says? Yogo says, Pastor Gene, you and Paul convict me very much. You know what happened? God was beginning to work again. And a pastor who had been, listen, it's not because that man has no faith, but it's because he'd been beaten down and alone for so long. And now all of a sudden, he could see the fire in my eyes, he could see the fire in his eyes, and he could see the fact that we were going to, and I think he started to feel, you know, the Americans are here, and they care more about Greece than I do right now. They're believing God more for Greece than I. You know what? We didn't. All we wanted to do was give them a little bit of fire. It's an amazing, beautiful, beautiful thing. I forgot what we're talking about here, but... we don't have to be ashamed of the high priest that we have. And this is what Apollos is going to show us. You don't have to be ashamed of this great high priest. When we left there, I'd walk in and I'd say to Pastor Yorgos or Eleni or Paul Wood, hey, I've got an idea, and they'd go, another idea, many ideas. They didn't believe we were ever coming back. They didn't believe we were ever coming back. And I said, what do you need more than anything, Yorgos? And you know what he said? He said, I need a rest. I need a rest. I said, I promise you, I'll do everything I can do when I get back to the States to get you a rest. I returned there 2 months later or 2.5 months later with Wayne with 5 round-trip tickets in my hand for him to come with his family for 6 months. 5 round-trip tickets, and we came back, and then you know what happened? They really started to trust us. And we won them. We won them. Now we're going over there, and we're going to conquer them this time. Okay? That was just laying the groundwork. We're going over there, and look out. Look out in July. Because God bless it. If it has breath, it's going to hear the gospel. Or see the gospel through mine, right, Jim? Okay. Well, we have some time left. Watch this now. He says in verse 10, "For God is not so unjust to forget your work and the love which you have shown towards his name in having ministered and is still ministering to the saints." Verse 11, "And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to realize the assurance of hope until the end." Now we come to a technical term here in the book of Hebrews, the word hope. The word hope is the Greek word elpis. You need to write this down. E-L-P-I-S. That's the major, that's like the root word of it, elpis. Now, elpis does not mean, boy, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow. That's not the hope we're talking about. That kind of hope isn't the anchor to anyone's soul. I mean, you know, it's like Art Lake. Art Lake, you know what? I've been going to the gym, okay? 2 weeks now I've been going to the gym. You probably noticed I'm whittling away to nothing. And but in the morning, I go and I jog on these fat boy machines. And I'm there there's a lot of elderly guys there that get up in the morning for the heart and everything. And I'm really getting to know some of these guys. It's a wonderful thing. But they've got this big screen, TV, and Art Lake is on every morning. And I don't know, how many know about Art Lake? Art Lake is the only weatherman who said that the blizzard of 78 was going to miss us. That's why he's on in the morning now. But you know what? I don't know what. I don't even know why I said that. Oh, yeah. That kind of hope, like Jamie always says, I like Art Lake. He sticks his head out the window and he makes the weather report, right? And he makes the weather report by looking out the window and telling you what the day is going to be like. That kind of hope is not what we're talking about. The word elpis is a Greek word which means an absolute, get this definition down, an absolute confidence. I want to hurry up and say it before the tape gets flipped over. An absolute confidence in a future event. An absolute confidence in a future event. An absolute confidence in a future event. Hope is an absolute confidence in a future event. Now watch this. When the Bible says that we have hope, hold fast to the hope. Hang on to the hope. What's it talking about? Not, I hope Jesus comes back. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But I have absolute confidence in something that is going to take place in the future. That's what that hope means. And that hope makes you a stable person. Now, there are actually three different kinds of hopes. And there are two of them that are in view here, okay? One is the hope of eternal salvation. That is going to be in view here. It's not in view in this particular verse, but as we move on a little bit, there's going to be a switch when they talk about the purpose of God. But the other hope is the hope. So these are the two hopes. I want you to get them down. The two hopes that are found here in Hebrews 6. The first hope is the hope of eternal salvation. The second hope is the hope or the absolute confidence in future eternal rewards. You have absolute confidence in the fact that you will be saved and that you will receive rewards in eternity future. Now those are the believers that continue to follow after Christ. Will receive those rewards. Okay, so now watch what it says, verse 11. We desire that each one of you should show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of the absolute confidence of the future blessings in the eternal realms. That's what that is saying. Okay, that's a paraphrase. But God's promise, we have absolute confidence in the fact that we will receive, if we're doing what Apollos is telling us here, we have absolute confidence in the fact that we will receive eternal rewards. That's a hope that we have. But it's not, oh boy, I really hope I get a crown. No, you will get a crown. All you have to do is abide in the vine. If you abide in the tree trunk, you'll bear fruit, glorify the Father, and you will also be blessed with eternal rewards forever. So he goes in verse 11, we desire that each one of you show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of our hope or our absolute confidence of future eternal rewards until the end. That is to the end of our race. And then he says, and you may not be sluggish, but rather be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherited the promises. Listen, you know, want to know something? This is beautiful. It says, I don't want you to be sluggish, he says. Don't be, you know, hard to hear. The word sluggish is actually the same word that is translated slow in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 11. Okay? Slow to learn. It's the same word that means, he goes, I don't want you to be slow. He says, I don't want you to be slow. I don't want you to be sluggish. He says, but rather than being sluggish, I want you to imitate those who, because of their, number one, their faith, believing God, and their patience, knowing that, hey, I don't have what God promised me yet, but I know it's coming. See what I mean? Faith, I'm believing God's promises, and patience, I'm waiting for God to give me his promises. You have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive what has been promised, right? Hebrews 10, 34 and 35. All right, now watch this. He says, but be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Do you want to know something? It doesn't say those who inherit the results of the promise. It doesn't say those who, in other words, God says, I'm promising you this. And then at the end of the line, you get what he promised, right? It doesn't say that these people inherited what they get at the end of the line. It says that they inherit the promises of God. And I want to show you how he illustrates it. He goes, let me give you an example. Abraham. He says in verse 13, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. Now, you know what? Abraham was put on the altar. Abraham put Isaac on the altar, and he was tested, and he sacrificed Isaac, but he stopped short, right? It was then there's a verse that's quoted. See verse 14 saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. The promise of the multiplication of the children of Israel that's quoted right here is from Genesis chapter 22, verse 16. Now, Abraham offered Isaac before that promise came. Abraham offered Isaac chapters before 22. Do you get the idea? So as a result of his faithfulness, God gave him more promises. But to Abraham, for God to give him a promise, it was done. Okay, Abraham, listen. From that boy, I'm going to make a great nation. Okay, God. Abraham, take that boy, bring him up to the mountain, and I want you to put a knife through him. Okay. Why could Abraham do that with no problem? I'm going to tell you why. Because Hebrews chapter 11 says that Abraham knew that if he put that knife right through his boy, that God would raise him right back up. Because you know why? God promised that that boy was going to be a great nation. And he could fill him full of holes. And it wouldn't matter. God had raised him right back up. And Hebrews 11 tells us that Abraham knew this when he had that knife in his hand. He said, listen, don't worry, boy. Don't worry. Don't worry about it. Where's the sacrifice? Don't worry, God's going to find a sacrifice. The amazing faith. God made a promise to Abraham, and in Abraham's mind, it was done. You see the idea? So listen to this. He says, I don't want you to be sluggish, but be imitators of those who through faith and patience in their life inherit promises. They get more promises. But to the faith man, the promise is just as good as the fulfillment of the promise. It's already done. Hey, guess what? You're glorified tonight. Does that mean anything to you? God promised you were. He said you're saved, but you're also glorified. For those who he foreknew, he also predestined. Those who he predestined, he elected. Those who he elected, he called. Those who he called, he also glorified. That's me. I'm glorified tonight. But I don't have a glorified body. Oh yeah, but I know, but I will. How do you know? Well, I know I'm saved, and I know I'm going to be glorified. Because God's promise is good with me. His word is good with me. Well, watch this, though. He says, when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. I like this. Watch this. He says, saying, I will surely bless and I will surely multiply you. You know, I'm going to really bless you, Abraham. And then he says, and thus having patiently waited, he obtained the promise, for men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath is given as confirmation. Let me start with verse 16. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. You know what it means? Somebody's got there's all kinds of things about this trial that's going to take place. Who knows? Whatever trial. And people are talking. People have all kinds of questions. Then all of a sudden, the witness takes the stand. Put your hand on the Bible. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? I do. He sits down. You know what? All disputes are over. If there would have been one guy who put his hand on that Bible and sat down in that box and said, I saw O.J. kill that woman, the case would have been over. Do you see the idea? Swear, but when they swear by someone greater than themselves. Put your hand on the Bible. Whose word is that? I swear to God. They swear by someone greater than themselves, and they appeal to someone greater than... But here's what it says. God, having no one greater than himself that he could swear on, he swore on himself. Is that unbelievable? God said, I swear to me that I am going to give you all the inheritances of the promises, like I'm saying. Listen to it. This is what it's saying. It's so incredible. Verse 13, for when God made a promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. I swear on a stack of what I've said. Okay. I swear on... He swore on himself. And that was an unshakable oath. Now listen, if one man could have stood there in the witness box and said, I saw O.J. do it, and that could have meant the damnation of O.J. Simpson, how much more do you think God giving a testimony in the courtroom of heaven that he is going to give us everything he promised? How much weight do you think that holds? All the angels hear that and they say, huh, it's done. Gene Jagir's glorified, it's done. Yeah, but he doesn't look glorified yet. Oh, you wait. God said it and he swore it by an oath. Really? What else? Only one thing? No, two things. Here are the two things. And then we'll read it, okay? Here are the two things. He goes, first of all, God swore on an oath. By the way, this is like verse 17 and 18. Here are the two things. Number one, God swore an oath. There's one unchangeable, unshakable reality. God said something and he swore it. That's it. It can never not happen, okay? And then second, as if that's enough, he also cannot lie. So the God who cannot lie and still be God swore an oath. Do you get the idea? So God puts his own uncompromisable integrity on the line that if any of this does not happen, I'm not God. And so it says, therefore, by two things, God proves this out. Let's read through it so we see the context now. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply you. And thus, having patiently waited, this is Abraham, he obtained the promise. Now, he obtained the promise, not the fulfillment of the promise. Abraham didn't see the fulfillment of his promise in his lifetime. He never, do you ever find that city? You know that city he's looking for. Do you ever find it? No. Will he? Sure will. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. It shuts everybody up. That's it. An oath has been given. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise, by the way, that's us, the unchangeableness of his purpose. And this, by the way, folks, is where the entire context begins to change a little bit, because salvation certainly comes into this. So it's not only salvation, but also the eternal rewards that are waiting for us in heaven. Now, I want to stop here for 1 second. Remember when we studied the angelic conflict, what is the great purpose of God in saving in saving believers? And certainly the great purpose that's in view in the book of Hebrews. That we would glorify God in the angelic conflict. Remember we saw it in Ephesians chapter 2 in verse 7. That God, or 6. 7. Okay. Ephesians 2, 7. That God is going to show his grace, manifest his grace to all of the angelic academy in the future eons by what? The church. By the glory that will be revealed in us. Now watch this. Eddie goes to heaven now, okay? Eddie gets all his promises. Eddie believed God. Eddie gets all his rewards. What do all those rewards do? Where'd the rewards come from? Grace. Did he earn them? No, they were already given to him. All he did is fulfill the potential that God had for him. He receives all the rewards that God already gave him by grace before the foundations of the world in Ephesians 1:3, right? Now he's got all these rewards. People look at him. Do they say, wow, Eddie, what a great guy. What do they say? No. They say, boy, God is magnificent. He deserves nothing, this guy. And God gave him everything. Look at the rewards he's got. So what does God do? Ephesians chapter... Let me read it to you again. I know it was on the exam, but listen to it. Ephesians chapter 2 in verse 6. He seated us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus in order that in the ages to come, that's the Omega ages, he might show the surpassing riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. That's God's great purpose. Now back in Hebrews chapter 6, look at this. In verse 17, in the same way, God desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed it with an oath, or sealed it with an oath, if you will. You get the idea? He swore it with an oath. So God said, I am going to tell you right now that my entire purpose, if you're going to say in one word, what is the purpose of God? Anybody know? One word. Grace. That is God's entire purpose, grace. Because in grace, the beneficiaries of grace, they don't deserve anything. They get everything that they don't earn and they don't deserve. And who gets the glory? The giver. That's the beauty of God's purpose. So he says in verse 17, in the same way, God desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise, that's us, the unchangeableness of his purpose. I was going to bring you to some amazing verses tonight on the uncompromisability of the essence of God. Like the Bible teaches that in God there is no, it says that all good gifts come down from heaven in James 1:17, from God who is in heaven, in whom there is no shadow of turning. You know what the word shadow of turning means? It's so unbelievable. You know what it means? It means that if I'm standing there in the sun and I turn, my shadow is going to move. See what I mean? The shadow like that's on the ground is going to move. It says God is so unchangeable that there's no possibility of a shadow even being cast because he moved. You get the idea? In whom there is no shifting shadow or no shadow of turning. That means there's no possibility of him to even, for his shadow to ever even move because he doesn't ever change. How about this one? Oh, I love this one too. 1 John chapter 1 verse 5. It says, God, the uncompromisability of God's essence. Listen to it. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. How do you like that verse? At all. I love those two words. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. God's essence is uncompromisable. And the uncompromisable essence of God stakes his own deity on the fact that these things will come to pass. Look at what else he says. He says, I got to start with verse 17 again. We're going to finish this tonight. We're going to finish up chapter 6 anyway. In the same way, God desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise, again, that's us, the unchangeableness of his purpose, that is grace and in the angelic, that is resolving the angelic conflict through grace, he interposed it with an oath in order that by two unchangeable things. What are the two unchangeable things? Number one, the oath, and number two, the fact that it's impossible for God to lie. You need to have that down in your notes. The two unchangeable things is that God made an oath and swore by himself, and number two, that it's impossible for God to lie. In the same way, God desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, in order that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement, we who have fled for refuge, laying hold of the hope which is set before us. And the word hope there brings in both of those connotations, one of salvation, eternal salvation, and the other of eternal blessings in the world to come. Now listen, when it says that we have fled for refuge, the idea there is like an army coming after you, like in the Middle Ages or something, an army's coming after you, and you don't have any weapons, and you run into the castle where they close the door. You see the idea? The idea is that you put yourself inside of a fortress which is impregnable, which can't be destroyed. So he says in verse 18, in order that by two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement. We who have fled, we've hid ourselves out in the castle of God's salvation, in laying hold of the hope which is set before us. And that hope, that absolute confidence of the fact that we'll be saved, and absolute confidence of the fact that we will receive eternal reward. And then he says, this hope we have as an anchor in the soul. And I would add to that, it's an anchor in the soul, which is in the harbor of God's purpose. The anchor which God has that stabilizes our soul is buried in the harbor of God's very purpose. Everything that is His purpose for our life. In other words, can anything ever undo God's purpose? No. And that's where our anchor is. It's in God's purpose. And the reason I say that is because that's meted out in the context in the C part of verse 17. Then he says, this hope we have is an anchor in the soul, both a hope sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. Do you know what that means? That means that our hope is anchored in the finished work. Jesus Christ went inside the veil, and he presented the blood once and for all. That's the finished work. And you know what? It's like Jesus took that anchor, okay? He says, okay, this anchor represents your salvation, and it represents the fact that you will have eternal blessings for all times from me. And he walked right inside the veil into the Holy of Holies, and he dropped it down. That's where it's anchored. It's anchored in the finished work. It's not based on what you do. You don't keep your ship from being blown apart. You don't keep your ship from breaking loose of the anchor. God does. And then watch this. Watch how it all comes together. It says where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, a prodromos, a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And the word forerunner there, according to the context now, deals with a person, a sailor, who would have a special boat. What would happen is, let's say the ship was in an area where it couldn't go in any further, but it was in a place where it couldn't set a good anchor. Here's what would happen. They would put the anchor in a smaller craft, and a sailor would go out ahead of the ship to the place where they wanted to put the anchor, where it was a sturdy place, and then that sailor would drop that anchor for the ship. You get the idea? So the forerunner means this, that we have a ship, okay? And the anchor, and we have an anchor to that ship that keeps us stable. And where did the anchor drop? It dropped right in the Holy of Holies, the place we could never go before. The anchor dropped right on the Ark of the Covenant, right in the finished work of Christ. You get the picture? And it says, and by the way, it says we have a forerunner who... Let me read it to you. It says, where Jesus entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever. The idea is that Jesus took that anchor, and he marched right into the Holy of Holies, went right through the veil, dropped the anchor right there, and said, anybody that believes in me, this is where their hope is staked. It's an amazing word picture. Do you see it? Do you see Christ walking into the Holy of Holies with an anchor that is our salvation and our promise of eternal blessing? And he says, I'm taking this anchor and I'm throwing it down. All you have to do is claim the blood and it's yours. I did it all. The work is finished. That's the amazing truth of Hebrews chapter 6. And then we have a beautiful segue here. He says, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And right from the word Melchizedek, we begin our extended look at the person and work of Jesus Christ, who is, and Melchizedek, who, of course, Melchizedek is a theophany of Christ. We begin chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10.